Production. Recorded live.
Head for sugary cereal.
Hi, welcome to Saturday Supercast, the show about the comics found at sugarycereals.com, and we also wind up talking about cartoons and things that inspired Sugary Cereals an awful lot. I am, for lack of a better term, your host, Jersey Drozd, and with me today, why don't you guys pipe in? Who do we got in here?
My name is Sean Robert. I run a little website called GrantedIn80s.com, and my wife is with me.
Hi.
Carrie.
So this is our first live episode after going daily with the Sugary Cereal site, and we'll just riff a little while we wait for people to show up. We've had somebody pop in and pop out again, but hopefully we'll get some more. But in the meantime, if nobody shows up, it'll just be the three of us, and that'll be just fine. We have plenty of things that we can riff about that we haven't had a chance to talk about on past Sugary Cereals or Saturday Supercast episodes. Is there anything in particular that you want to start with, Sean? Or am I putting you on the spot?
No, I was just trying to think of how's everything been going as far as doing the daily updating, and we were talking earlier about you not getting too much response to the comic yet. But how about some of the other contributors? Have they been looking at some of the stuff now that, Chet Lucero's first 8 pages are up?
Yeah, I guess we could do like a little State of the Union kind of thing. The thing I try to remember so far is that we're really only, 11 pages in to the anthology proper. But we do have the first 8 pages available. You know, the first act of the first story is up and viewable. And, I mean, there was actually some good interaction going on in the comments threads on those pages. And, I mean, let's face it, and you can go back to Saturday Supercast, the last episode, episode 7, I think, where the interview with Chet, we talk a little bit about that. He does some really amazing storytelling in his work. So I was glad to start the series off with his stuff. And the thing that's also we have to try to remember is we're working like 3 months ahead of time, or more than that, actually. I'm actually doing the graphic design work for issue 5 right now. So I just put issue 4 to bed. We just finished all the nitty-gritty stuff on that, and now we're getting geared up to put issue 5 together. And the deadline for that is like in a couple days. So the creators, I'm working with creators that really don't have much of a presence on the site just yet. They have some of them have some stuff in the preview book, but some of them don't have anything on the site just yet. So there's a lot of interaction going on behind the scenes, and hopefully after the first month comes and goes, we can get more of them interacting with the readers on the actual site itself. But it's you know, the thing I try to remember is we're really only 2 weeks into the game. And even though the preview site was up, the thing that, you know, I got some emails from people saying, like, well, I was going to post in the forums, but there's not much to post on just yet, you know, because there's just a preview book. So now the site is up, and once the first issue is in the can, you get the first three acts, or the first acts of the first three stories, and then hopefully we'll get some reader participation going on there. And that's also what this podcast is about. This is all trying to create some extra content for people to participate with.
Yeah.
I mean, this ties. Go ahead, Sean.
Well, I was just gonna talk about Jim Plum Defenders a little bit, but
sure.
I wanted to. Yeah, I was just gonna say that I really liked. Well, like you said, you definitely mentioned this in the podcast with Chet, but he really was doing some really interesting things with the panel work on a lot of the pages. Like I said, I'm not. Super familiar with his work. I haven't looked at his online comic Storm Core yet, but I was really impressed with the storytelling elements. Like for instance, like you guys, once again, you guys brought this up before, but on the first page, it's up on the site that they introduce you to the world in the dreams, but everything on the top half of the page is actually within a thought bubble, but it's still broken down into like a comic book format.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, there's just a lot of really dynamic things like that that I found really interesting.
Yeah, that he really caught me by surprise with how deeply he thinks about his work. And what's great about him is he's one of those guys where he thinks really deeply about it, but he doesn't make a big fuss over it. I mean, I'll go on record to say that I could support the argument that maybe I can walk on the line of pretentiousness when I start talking about thinking too hard about your work. But Chet is one of those guys where it's just like, he's like, oh yeah, that was pretty cool. I did that. And I'm foaming at the mouth over it. You know, I remember emailing him when the pages were coming in, this is months back. And I kind of felt like, oh gee, am I, you know, it's almost like, this is going to sound weird, but it's almost like when you're dating a girl and you're like, am I coming on too strong? Because I'm like sending these I'm sending them these emails where I'm like, oh my God, that was the most brilliant use of sound effect. Like, on page 2, when they blow up the meteor, mm-hmm. and Spacey and Jake jump up in the air, and the entire background becomes the word "yeah." That's one of those neat things you get to do in comics, where sound can become visually like their whole. I talked about this in some previous podcasts, where when I was a kid, I walked into an electric fence, and my entire world became that sensation of pain. And I remember that in terms of using the word or the panel border to become the sound itself, because if the panel border represents the reality in which the characters live, if you make the panel border the sound effect, then it's all there is. The spaceship to them, the spaceship disappeared, space disappeared. All it was that cheer of triumph. You know, mm-hmm. So some of that immediate kind of cool stuff you can do in comics that you can't do in other mediums. So, and Chet, he really gets it. And yeah, Stormcore is really great. I mean, there's some really powerful storytelling moments in there, and also he's so good with color. He's so good with his color choices. So
I like, too, how he's got quite a few of the panels as the dream world is breaking up, where it's the panel itself is just sort of breaking apart, where it's not a matter of it, that the panel encapsulates the world breaking apart. No, it's the actual panel that's going away.
Right, right. And What's weird is that whenever I see like amazing things like this, I'm always trying to think of, well, what other mediums could this work in? Because I don't ever want to say like, oh, this is something you can only do in comics, and have somebody say, well, actually. But I think if you did this in film, it wouldn't work as well because the screen is always there to remind you that it's a film. Whereas panels are, there's this assumption that panels, because they're on a page, that's the window into the world. And so if you crack the window of that world, then the world shatters. The only other person I've seen do this is in Crisis on Infinite Earths number, I want to say 10. It's the one where they have the fight at the dawn of time, and the Spectre and the Anti-Monitor are like wrestling at like the nexus of time beginning, and the panels literally turn into glass and shatter, and then just like the last panel of the page is just pieces of falling glass with no border. That's the only other place I've seen anything like that. But that was a really clever technique that Chet did. Chet's awesome. If you're listening, Chet, you rule. But there's also some really good stuff coming up in Mark's Curse of the Pharaohs. Sean, I believe you've seen some of those pages. And
that's going to be silly. Yeah. I've said this before, but I'm looking forward to pretty much everything coming out. But I'm definitely looking forward to Curse of the Pharaohs because I'm sort of an unofficial monster kid. I don't feel in so much so, like, I don't know. There's people out there, and there's some actors out there and stuff that like Rob Zombie and stuff that are just total. I mean, their entire house is decorated with monster stuff. I'm not quite that far into it, but I've always responded really well to monster theming and things. And even though I don't think the mummy stuff plays deeply into it as you know, as much as I'm thinking it might, but it's just that one's really definitely getting me excited.
Yeah, that's the neat thing that he does. He does a little, and I don't want to spoil too much, but he it's a mummy story, but it's not what you would tend to think of as your typical mummy story. He pulls kind of a bait-and-switch thing with that, where it's the mummies still play into it, but it's not in the way that we typically think of mummies. So Yeah, and there's lots of monster action in that thing, lots of mystical stuff. It's just a lot of fun. Mark has found a story where he can balance really scary stuff with really fun stuff, and it never crosses the line too far into too scary for me. I tend to try to be a little overzealous with the stories to make sure that we're not doing anything that overly litigious people could come in and get us for, you know, because it's a scary thing to promise that your stuff is all ages, because that's just like inviting somebody to come in and be a little specific, you know.
Exactly. Here at Boston Market, we have 6 million different variations of combinations of food you can have.
Do they really say that?
They said something like that. And then a classroom of kids came in, and I think the math teacher actually brought them on a field trip to illustrate that, no, you couldn't have 6 million different combinations. And the company had to rescind their ad campaign.
So they should have had an asterisk on the end of that, and then in the bottom corner of the screen just put, not really. And then they could have gotten away with it.
Yeah, this is new math.
Speaking of monsters, though, I want to take this chance to give you a little plug. You are doing daily updates for the month of October on BrandedInThe80s.com. And that's nothing to sneeze at for a guy who does this as a part-time, non-paying gig.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one thing if you're like a quote-unquote professional blogger and this is where your main source of income, yeah, you better be posting 3 times a day. But for somebody who's just and especially in a lot of cases when I'm looking at blogs, it's more like it's almost like a tumble log where it's like a guy says like, oh yeah, Dick Cheney said something funny today. Go to USA Today to find out what it is. Whereas yours are like the really deep, rich commentary on cartoons. You're doing a lot of this just sounds funny to say, but you're doing like you know, journalistic legwork going out to the store saying, here's where there's some great costume choices going on, like that recent report you did on Target.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of that stems from the fact that it's not that I don't enjoy the first type of blogs as far as reading them. But as far as writing them, I really do feel like I'm copping out if I'm just sort of pointing around a lot. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I mean, that's what the internet's built on, is links.
But, oh, sure.
I like to try to do something a little bit more. But yeah, no, I was really influenced by another popular pop culture blog, xentertainment.com, and he's been doing a Halloween thing for years, and it's something, like I said, that I really respond well to, so it felt like it'd be fun to sort of challenge myself this month and see if I could come up with content on a daily basis.
He also has a very supportive and understanding wife.
Yeah, we can't overlook that.
Yeah. a sharing of the computer and finding time to blog.
Oh, wow. You guys share a computer and yet you do this daily updating thing?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I'd say that you deserve a humanitarian award for that, for putting up with his.
Well, really putting up with him, period, but.
Well, anyway, people should be going to the site to lovers of Halloween should be visiting Brandon in the 80s, because it's not just about the 80s this month, it's about Halloween in general. And you got a contest on there.
Yes, I do, yeah.
You should make some noise about that.
Yeah, I decided to break down and share a Halloween album that I've loved for years. It's the only one I've ever had. My family bought it when I was born, around 1977 or so. And I was sort of typing up the post, and I was considering sharing all the different sound effects on the B-side of the album. And I was trying to think that, well, on the one hand, it's probably kind of cool for people to get an idea of what was on the album, but on the other hand, are people going to click through 56 different sound effects? And I thought I'd try to make it fun for people to create a contest. And it's like, if anyone wants to record their own ghost story, which is actually the purpose of the album to begin with, it provided all these sound effects so you could sit down and sort of make your own little radio show. And I thought it'd be fun. If anyone wanted to do that, then they can go ahead and email those to me by October 30th. And my wife and I and my depressed-looking dog and my annoying cat will judge them.
Well, I know of at least one of my readers, Tom Foolery. Hi, Tom. He I'm sure will be excited to do that. He's sent me little audio plays in the past that he's worked on. This is something he gets excited about.
Oh, cool.
I tried to make some noise about it on my site for that reason. But, I mean, I'm thinking that, you know, these days it's so easy. And, like, you yourself linked to Audacity in the post.
Yeah.
A free audio editor. I mean, and I was thinking, like, if nothing else, even if you don't win anything, you've made something that's going to be really fun to have around for future Halloween parties and things like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things about your site that I love, and I probably talked about this elsewhere, but it seems like it's this great documentation of a period of our lives, at least guys and gals who grew up in the 80s, but also just in terms of, you know, I don't know, I want to get you guys' input on this. What do you think about this? You know how when you're watching Back to the Future, when he goes back to 1955, it's like you can put like 5 or 6 different items together and boom, you've got 1955 as an era. Like visually, you can represent that so easily. And then like Back to the Future 2, when Marty goes into that cafe that's supposed to be like the 80s cafe, and there's some of that stuff there, but I always wondered, is the 50s more supremely iconic than other decades? And does the 80s have, like, oh, here's the 6 things, and boom, you think of the 80s? Or is the only way we can do it with, like, television shows, and, you know, you have to put Magna P.I. and Riptide and ALF together in order to have the 80s? Like, you can't evoke it as much with style.
It's harder to do that. I think part of it's that we aren't far enough away from it. It hasn't become quaint yet. Because I've noticed that when I first started thinking about doing the blog, it's like, well, what am I going to talk about? Well, you know, I didn't want to do some things that seem like very obvious and on the surface, but at the same time, I just don't think there's enough distance. So I do think some of that stuff there. I mean, if you look at like the new wave movement, and the crazy gelled up hair and stuff, not really punk, but sort of crazy stuff. It's definitely something that fits in the 80s. It feels like it fits in the 80s. But at the same time, go back and look at how kids were dressing in the 80s, and it wasn't all, you know, a whole heck of a lot different than they're dressing today.
Yeah.
Except for maybe knee-high socks.
I'm seeing a little bit of that. I got a whole bunch of youth clothing catalogs like Urban Outfitter and Delia's and things like that for reference because I'm doing a comic story right now that takes place on a college campus. And I wanted it to feel, you know, I want my kids to be dressed fairly timely, and I don't know much about fashion on my own. So, and I'm noticing that like a lot of purples and pinks. And of course, like a lot of, I guess, like a big thing right now is like t-shirts. These girls are all wearing t-shirts with like Optimus Prime on them, and like rainbows and unicorns. And so I'm just noticing that some of that stuff is, the kitsch of it all is like, oh, that's it's cute because you're referencing a time period that they weren't alive in, I guess.
Yeah. That's actually a good point. I was curious when we were talking about like the 50s can be so iconic. Did, you know, 20 years after, you know, in 1970, were people, I guess, I mean, it feels like when I go back, everything that I'm judging on what it was like in the 50s, I'm judging off of movies and TV, which is kind of skewed. But
yeah.
It feels quaint, and it feels like a not simpler, but a more, I'm not sure the word I'm looking for. But, it's, you know, were there ironic people walking around, you know, with 50s haircuts and 50s clothing style, or were they saving up in their first car? Was it, you know, an old Studebaker or something? was this happening in the 70s? It's happening now. The 80s is coming back for the kids, like you said, that were just born outside of it, or you know, were 1 year old when this was going on.
Yeah.
And it seems like in the 90s we did that. We cannibalized the 70s.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I'm just curious if this is something that's been going on consistently. I can't remember in the 80s if there was a bunch of people, like, if the hippie thing came back.
Actually, I just had a really funny realization about, well, I don't want to say realization, but I'm noticing a pattern about growing up where this seems like not referential to a specific decade, but more like just like my wife and I have noticed a pattern amongst guys who consider themselves to be intellectuals, and I don't mean that in a disparaging way. It's nice to want to be smart, and everybody should try to be as smart as they can. But we've noticed a pattern of these guys who walk around with a copy of something by J.D. Salinger under their arm, and they suddenly are really, really into the Beatles and possibly also Ayn Rand. And we wonder if this is like some kind of rite of passage for intellectual guys. They have to go through like a slight pseudo-hippie beatnik phase. And
yeah.
A lot of people we knew when we were in our late teens, early 20s, did that, and we're noticing that there's kids today. We live in a town where there's a college campus, and we see these kids walking around with a copy of Catcher in the Rye, and they got the title prominently facing out so everybody can see that they think everybody else is phony. So anyway, that's something that at least has been around as long as since we were teens. But yeah, you're right. I remember very specifically Mark Rudolph and I, when we were 15, we found a copy of the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack on vinyl. And we played Disco Inferno over and over again, laughing hysterically. And we referred to that movie all the time because, like, oh, it was so – everybody was so sleazy in the 70s, and weren't we clever for referring to it constantly?
I had very similar experiences. My parents had a copy of the original album that had Disco Inferno on it. I can't remember if it was Tramps or what, but I did the same thing. I took it straight out of their collection spun it a million times out of irony, I guess.
Yeah, it was like some kind of form of irony. You know, I seem to remember like the DA haircut at least being around in some way or another in the late 70s. Wasn't that part of the punk movement? Weren't there guys who were wearing leather jackets and the DA haircuts? Like, I could be wrong.
Yeah. I think so.
And Happy Days. Happy Days came around when? Like the mid-70s, late-70s, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's true. But
so it was Go ahead.
I guess there's sort of like a 20-year differential.
Yeah. Yeah, like the Wonder Years came out in the
80s. Yeah.
So, yeah, there's like this... And Stand By Me is what... supposedly inspired the Wonder Years, and that came out in the 80s, and it's just about a guy looking back 20 years and when he was 11 years old or whatever. So,
yeah.
I guess that's just the pattern that's going to happen. So, but I think. What do you wonder?
Well, I wonder kind of why that is, because I stop and think about it, and it's like, you know, it does feel about time for people to start, and there is. There's like four different movies in the makings about what it was like to go see Star Wars for the first time. And you've seen this in pop culture references on and off, but it's like, you know, where's my Stand By Me, but for, you know, my generation, for the 80s or something like that.
This is something that I have talked about with off the air with other people, and I still haven't formulated my opinion on this, so I'm interested in hearing what your take is on it. But I'm curious if... The 70s seemed like it was a fairly I only lived, 6 years in the 70s, so, you know, I can't say for sure. I was just a little kid in the 70s. But looking back, it seems like it was a fairly cynical time. And the 80s, and this could be because of the age I was in the 80s, seemed to be a little bit more of an earnest time. Like, movies like Stand By Me could come out where a guy could be just genuinely nostalgic and it didn't seem trite. People actually bought it. And then the 90s, again, we went back to the cynicism, like, it smells like Teen Spirit. The video comes out, and suddenly there's this whole age of people just feeling rotten all the time, it seemed like. And again, this could be more of a reflection of the age I was at that time. I was 18, 19 years old, so everybody around me was very sad because they were teenagers, and that's what teenagers do. But it seems to me that we're currently in the tail end of a very cynical time where it's better to, or it's cooler to sneer at something than to genuinely love, to like lovingly respect something, or to, not that people are being disrespectful. I don't want to say that, but I want to qualify this with, you know, Tom Root, who writes Robot Chicken. I mean, he's a friend of mine, and I like him, and I like his work. I like his writing, and the jokes that he writes on Robot Chicken, I can usually spot because they're genuinely good jokes. Where's I going with this? I'm just trying to like qualify my statement and say I'm not attacking anybody here. I'm just saying that there's I get this general feeling of it's better to be to sneer at something. It's more funny to sneer at something than to make a joke where it is just okay, the only example I have offhand is, I've talked about this before, is in Silver and the Periodic Forces, that comic I did, there are these ads in there that are referential to 80s ads that played during cartoon times, like cereal ads and things like that, right? The Yummy Mummy ads, Count Chocula ads, and whatever. And I asked some other artists to join me in doing some ads for future issues of Silver, and they wanted to do parody. And I was like, no, there's a difference between doing parody and doing loving tribute. A loving tribute is you're saying, isn't it wonderful how funny this is and how corny it is, but you're doing it out of respect and admiration for it, kind of wallowing in the corniness of it, whereas a parody is kind of pointing at it and laughing and saying how stupid that is. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely.
And it seems like we're in, from my standpoint, more of a parodical period, more of a cynical period, more of a sneering period, and it seems like we're due for, like, here we go. Everybody's talked about this. In Star Wars documentaries, to go back to that, everybody talked about how Star Wars was a breath of fresh air because every movie at that time that was like a big hit was some kind of disaster film. The Towering Inferno, Soylent Green, what was the one? The Poseidon Adventure. You know, these movies where just everybody dies, right? How does Soylent Green end? It ends with them carting off Charlton Heston, him screaming, "You gotta tell him Soylent Green is people," whatever. Yeah, and the end of Planet of the Apes, you know, he finds out that apes did win, you know. And then Star Wars comes out, and it's like, oh, wouldn't it be nice if we just got along and, you know, we trusted our instincts and, you know, we'll win. And everybody's like, oh, what a breath of fresh air, because the 70s was a more cynical time. And Star Wars ushered in this age of blockbusters where the good guys wore white, their hat never fell off, and they always punched the bad guy in the face. So I've been kind of wondering, are we due for another turnaround like that? When is that thing going to come along that's going to be like, oh, and I thought the new Superman film was going to be that, but it didn't do it for me. I don't know about you.
No, it tried. Well, actually, I don't know. I'm not sure what it tried to do. I think actually something that falls a little bit more in that frame of reference is probably the Fantastic Four movies.
Yes. I totally agree with that. Did you like those movies at all?
I really enjoyed the first one. I haven't seen the second one yet. My wife has, but even though a lot of people knock them because they're fun, and yeah, the good guys win and the bad guys don't, and there isn't a whole lot of angst and questioning, and it's more of just, you know, heroes doing what heroes do. And it is funny that that people look at that negatively. Well, I mean, I'm guilty of it. When the Daredevil movie came out, and I had just finished reading the Kevin Smith graphic novel where he'd done his take on it, and Kevin Smith was actually, I don't know, it's decent. It was part of the whole Marvel Knights thing, so it was a little grittier, and it was getting into a little darker place with Daredevil. And when the movie came out, I just was sitting on the edge of my seat waiting for just gritty fighting and super realistic, you know, battles, and I don't know why. I don't know, it's odd.
Well, I think Daredevil... Actually, and I have not seen the movie, but I think Daredevil is one of those characters more along the lines of Batman, where you have to, he only feels proper in a darker, I mean, his turf is called Hell's Kitchen, right? I mean, he tends to live in a grittier world, at least the more popular renditions of Daredevil. Neil Adams, in many interviews, has said when he ushered in this new age of Batman getting darker and working at night and always disappearing when Commissioner Gordon turns his back, before that, we had the 60s kitsch Batman, where he was like walking around at daytime, sitting in a coffee shop in full uniform, you know, talking with Commissioner Gordon, and kids walking around saying, "Hey, look, it's Batman." And Julius Schwartz, this is all according to Neil Adams, Julius Schwartz turned to him after he was doing some, I think it was Brave and Bold or World's Finest, whichever he was doing. He was working on not a main Batman title, he was working on one of the anthology books. And Schwartz was getting all these emails, or not emails, snail mails from people saying, that they loved the Neil Adams Batman. And so Schwartz says to Neil Adams, what do you know, or you think you know what Batman should be like, huh? And Neil Adams says, not me, every kid in America. So there are some characters where it seems like they just belong in a certain kind of interpretation, and anything else feels kind of phony by comparison. But Fantastic Four, that's a Stan Lee, Jack Kirby comic, and there's a certain... You walk into it with a certain suspension of disbelief. You know they're going to be fighting like a cosmic entity called Galactus, you know, and there's certain things that you don't open up a Fantastic Four book, at least I don't, and expect to find like really gritty, hard hitting issues. They're a cosmic team, for crying out loud. They save the entire universe and they travel through time. They're not going to be dealing with day to day stuff. So to that extent, I felt the movies were actually very, very accurate to the feeling and tone of the comics, and I had a ball at them. I love those movies. I saw both the first and the second one, and one of the things I said to my wife was when I saw Superman 2 in, what was it, 1980 or whatever, 81, yeah. I saw it with my little brother, and you know, I'm assuming you both have seen Superman 2, the Christopher Reeve one. We walked out of that theater so juiced with all the action and adventure and awesomeness that we literally started beating each other up because we were so excited we didn't know what to do with that energy. We came out of the theater and just started beating the heck out of each other. And I said to my wife, when are we going to get that movie again? I want to walk out of a movie and feel like beating on my little brother kind of thing.
Superman just because inspires violence.
Yeah. Well, I should be careful. I did not pick up like a shovel or anything. It wasn't like that scene in They Live with Roddy Piper and what's his name, that 15-minute fight scene. But we were just little kids, you know. We were jumping on each other and everything, the way little brothers and older brothers do. And I wanted that feeling again when I came out of the movie. And Fantastic Four was the first time since then that I walked out feeling like, oh, yeah, I'm 8 years old again. So, yeah, the second one is just as good, if not better, except that there's still the same problems with Dr. Doom, with them playing him totally off. And there's one really, truly bad joke. And it was clearly the joke they threw in so that the dads would pay attention to the movie. But everything else is just absolutely superb. And like the climax, there's like parts of the climax that don't even make any sense, but it's like, it doesn't matter. It's a Stanley Jack Kirby story, you know? So.
No,
yeah.
It'll be interesting to see what Steven Spielberg does with the new Indiana Jones movie.
Yeah.
I'm curious if that's going to get, because that was one of my problems with the Star Wars prequels, is that they were, I'm not sure, I have a lot of problems with Star Wars prequels, but coming out of them, I didn't feel nearly the way I felt about them tone-wise as I did about the first series of movies, and it feels like it's trying to tell two completely different stories that really don't bookend well for me. And I don't know if it's because Lucas is in a different place in his life, or he's looking to tell a different kind of story, or he's trying to appease the fans, or what goes on there. But I'm curious with Spielberg, because he seems to be pretty... He stays pretty consistent. He knows how to tell a certain kind of story, a certain kind of way. And the Indiana Jones movies, you know, they feel like that early 80s. And even though they're set in the 40s, you know, they just have that, I don't know, that it's fun to be a hero.
Yes.
Kind of feel to him. I'm curious how he's going to handle it.
I am too, and I'm actually pretty nervous about it because I don't want to go to an Indiana Jones film and walk out not thrilled. There's the quintessential Indiana Jones moment for me that sums up if you distill all the feelings of an Indiana Jones film into one little tiny bottle, it's from the Temple of Doom. He's on that conveyor belt and there's that big dude beating the living heck out of him, and the kid's up in the little platform with the voodoo doll and stabbing him in the back repeatedly, and Harrison Ford's doing that magnificent screaming that he's so famous for whenever he's in pain, right, where you really feel his pain because he knows how to emote it. And there's that scene where he's just about to go under the rock crusher, and then Short Round knocks the voodoo doll out of the kid's hand, and Indiana Jones looks over his shoulder with that look like, now you're going to get it. You know the moment I'm talking about? He does that look like, oh, I'm okay now, and I'm going to get you. And then they even do this thing where they cut away where he's punching the big guy, and they cut back to, what's her name, the love interest in the movie. She's like doing like some air punching, like just like we should be doing, right?
Exactly.
That is the moment that I am desperate to create a hero who can capture that feeling. Like I was talking with Mark Rudolph, I'm like, we need to design the great American hero again. We need to bring him back where it's okay to make a guy who punches people in the face, and it's for America, right? It's for the good guys. It's somebody you can put the flag behind, and it doesn't feel dumb. It doesn't feel forced or phony.
Yeah.
And that's what Indiana Jones really, I mean, that scene, like, is the perfect distilled example of that. Hey, we got some new people in here. I see a caller from Hawaii, and I'm thinking that might be Kitsy and Kimono Stereo of Nemu Nemu. I'm going to see if I can let them in. They're only called in on the phone. Let's see if we can get them in here. Hello, or is the caller there?
Hello.
Is this who I think it is?
Yes, it is.
Well, hey, welcome to the show. So far, it's just been me and Sean Robert and his wife. Oh, my gosh, I am so sorry that I can't remember your name now.
That's okay. It's Carrie.
Carrie. I almost said Kathy, and I don't want to do that to people. And people call me Jerry all the time. Carrie, okay. We've just been talking about, I don't know how we got on it, but we're talking about 80s movies. But now that you're here, we can talk about comics again.
Oh, we're listening in.
Yeah, we're listening in, and Scott was kind of filling in on all the, before you finish your sentences, he was starting to fill you in, on, fill me in on what you were going to say next. It was kind of interesting.
The Temple of Doom thing?
Oh, the Poseidon Adventure, and then Fantastic Four.
All the tragedy movies of the 70s.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I'm right about those either. I'm just kind of going off of my gut instinct and personal experience, so I don't have a degree in film history on that.
On the same wavelength.
So, guys, I have been reading the Nemu Nemu collection, and it is so, so awesome. There's so many laugh-out-loud moments in that book.
Oh, well, thank you very much for participating in our strip this past week. It was really, really well-received.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Actually, we have one person who was asking if you could, if you guys are ever going to participate again in a guest strip.
Oh, wow. That's incredibly flattering. I want to help bring "Oh my pizza" into the public consciousness as a catchphrase. That is the best catchphrase ever.
It's interesting how that's what most people pick up on right away is that "Oh my pizza," and that was kind of something that we just did as a side joke, and
mm-hmm.
people just kind of picked it up the way I kind of hoped they would.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the very first use of it in the collection is especially funny. That's the best time it happens is when Aunt Pen wakes up and he was trying to do a good thing for a niece, and instead it backfires on him, and he has this the Macaulay Culkin moment.
Definitely.
So this is a good opportunity. Sean in the past has mentioned this idea of getting a conversation going on why webcomics, and I know my reasons, but you know I don't profess to know the reasons. So Sean, did you want, now that we got some other webcomics creators in here, did you want to maybe, did you have any questions in mind for where you want to attack this subject?
Yeah, I guess, I don't know, maybe starting from the point of view, I remember back in the 90s when I wanted to do comics, and the first thing that came to my mind is, you know, how was I going to print these? How was I going to sell them? How did this work? How do I get into Diamond Previews? How do I, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I know it was a really, really daunting thing. I mean, getting comics printed was expensive. Getting them solicited wasn't easy. And, you know, now that, like I said, I was completely oblivious to webcomics except until, like, the past year or so, and looking at it, it seems like it's this perfect way to circumvent that, but at the same time, there's the whole idea of, I guess, of giving away your stuff for free online, and I'm just curious from a creator standpoint how you make that leap.
Is that for us?
Yeah, go. You guys go ahead and take it first.
Okay.
She's pointing at me, so... Well, I don't know. I think even doing the webcomics thing, it has its own set of, I wouldn't call them problems, but its own set of little things that you got to work around in order to get found out about. I mean, Nemo Nemo itself is still relatively unknown out there, but we've been trying just about everything that we can to get people to notice the comic strip, aside from... paying for advertising, word of mouth is probably the best bet. When back in the 80s, I remember trying out to be an inker at Marvel, and it was quite expensive experience sending, ink copies of stuff that you've done, sending it over, and then, you know, waiting 3 or 4 months and getting a rejection letter or something, and I kind of gave up on that whole hope of doing a comic strip until a little bit after I started doing something for the college newspaper and whatnot. I kind of ended after that college and didn't really look at comics for a while. But for Kitsy, she was doing comics as well. And when we got together, we said, hey, why not do a webcomic? It might be a good way to get noticed, and we can do a story at the same time.
I think in a lot, because my personal background has been, I did college comics, and before that I used to just do little drawings with friends for friends. And those things were, it was just personal jokes that were being passed back and forth, and that's how things started off for me. And I personally like the idea of just being able to tell stories of my life through drawings, because I think that's what I can do best. To me, web comics is almost a little bit like blogging, but with illustrations. And because the internet is so big, so vast, there's so many people who are just accessible there, I think it's a little bit easier to get work out into the public. It is a little bit more difficult to get yourself noticed because you're basically in a sea of other fish, and you just have to make your fish stand out a little bit more from everyone else somehow. But I mean, I look at the things that I've done in the past where it has been printed, or, you know, either through like, you know, trash can anthologies, newspaper printings. I did a little bit of work with Marvel when I was living in California. I used to color backgrounds, and I worked a little bit with Antarctic Press, and I did a couple of their issues as well. And I don't know. I think because I can work for myself, I can do a story that I want to do. I can work at my own pace, and I can upload them as I'm ready with them. And I can get immediate feedback from people. I think that makes it a much more personal experience rather than me printing a book and having it, you know, maybe get into the bookstores.
Yeah, really. Do you find that it also, I mean, this was a big attraction for me, was not having to sell the idea to anybody, not having to beg somebody to get behind it, and then have them have some input on it?
Exactly.
That was one of the big things that we discussed in the very, very beginning stages of this comic, was how we were going to get published in the end. We kind of looked at what Tokyo Pop was doing with its Rising Stars of Manga, but after I took a look at their contracts, or what people said were part of their contracts, I'm like, there's no way we would do something like this. We're not going to give away the property, and, you know, we're not even thinking about lending the property to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I hear that. Yeah, when I finished the front last year, I shopped it around to several different publishers, and the ones who did bite sent me their contracts. And, yeah, it was like, some of them were like that they wanted a 10-year rights to the book. They'd get exclusive publishing rights for 10 years, and I wouldn't be able to publish it on my own or anything like that.
Yeah.
And that's just insane to even loan it to them for that long. And I did some work for Antarctic Press as well, and I will say for them at least, you know, when I was finished with the project that I did with them, I was free to do whatever I wanted with it. I don't know why anybody would take a project that they pour their guts into like that and sell it or give it away.
I guess I guess it depends on what type of creator you are. If you've got tons of good ideas and you don't feel like, you know, you can just sit on one idea and you could do something else, then maybe that way to go might be good for somebody doing that. But I just remember back in the early 80s, I mean, creators' rights was a big, big movement in comics. When John Byrne created Alpha Flight and he lost it to Marvel, because, you know, he had no other way to get it out there.
Right. That's very true. And you raise a good point. I mean, I remember doing a piece last year for Glencoe McGraw-Hill where they essentially asked me to do what I was doing on The Replacements with Sarah Turner. Like, they asked us just to do that again for them, but they get to own it. And it was full creative freedom. We could do whatever we want, but they would ultimately own it. And it was just it was fun to do because it was just a side project thing. It was like, well, we can put, you know, this amount of energy into it, and it'll look good, and they'll like it, and we'll make some pretty good money off of it. Do you guys find that that kind of stuff is happening for you with your site? Are you getting, like, your site's serving as, like, a portfolio piece for you?
It's starting to become that. I think one of the things that we had discussed before was that we need to put more content on our site as far as Kitsy's work is concerned. That's just a matter of sitting down and getting it all up there. She spent a good part of the week last month, for a couple of days scanning in some of her older stuff, and it's just a matter of getting that type of portfolio work out there and getting her name out there again.
Mm-hmm. Nemu Nemu for me is kind of like a, it feels like a like an ongoing practice run. I get to try different things. I get to experiment with things. I get to it's just ongoing. It's a learning process from day one all the way up until now. I keep changing things. I keep, you know, brainstorming with Scott about, you know, ideas and how to change things, how to make things better, how to change my techniques. And so it for me, it's a work in progress more than a portfolio at the moment. Although I do want people to see the progress of from where I started about 2 years ago now, all the way up until now. And I'd like to think that people can see the progression.
Yeah, that's a big difference.
I mean, yeah. I did Nemu Nemu like when I had taken basically about a year, 2 year break from drawing in general, and I was just doing coloring at that point. So I hadn't really done a whole lot of my own creative work. It was mostly just doing work for other people to kind of help them finish their work. So for me to actually start up my own comic again after, gosh, it had been almost 5-6 years out of college at that point when I had done my Culture Shock and other projects at that point. I was really rusty. I had to rethink on how I did things. I had to kind of research a little bit about, you know, how to make the panels work and fit the text in and all that stuff. I made a lot of mistakes along the way, but I think it's been a really good learning experience from that point all the way up until now.
Yeah, I mean, if nothing else, doing a comic that you make a commitment to update regularly, besides generating readers that way, it's fitness, right? It's like it's keeping you in shape and it's keeping you in the seat doing the work, so that of course you're going to get better. That's going to happen just from sitting down and doing it every day. So that's another benefit of doing a webcomic, I think, is it's a way to keep yourself honest and keep yourself working on stuff, even if you're not doing any quote-unquote professional work at the time. So, but
even
I
can definitely... For us, it's a really good is a good exercise, too. It's very different from what we're doing on our site, and I get to do stuff that I used to do when I was coloring for Marvel and you know, put it into my strip, which is actually kind of fun. It is time-consuming, but it is fun.
Sean, you were going to say something?
Well, I was going to say that you guys made a great point about a correlation between webcomics and blogging. I can totally see that. I think I'm still, my mindset is still stuck in the indie self-publishing industry, like trying to, I want to, you know, say this first, that I'm not trying to say that you can't do this, but I understand that it's really hard to make a living at just doing comics. But that was one of the things that I was looking toward when I was coming out of high school, and the kind of comics I was buying at the time, like Terry Moore's Strangers in Paradise and Drew Hayes' Poison Elves, books like that. And I was thinking that, like, doing your own independent comic, getting it printed and selling it yourself, almost from, like, a career path standpoint. And when I guess that's where my question comes in with webcomics, is that I look at it as sort of giving up whatever bit you would get back from selling your comics to keep yourself going, even if it's not something that's going to keep you fully employed. You sort of almost give that up by becoming a webcomics publisher, if that makes sense.
I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. What you're saying,
well,
that,
like, for instance, you know you've got your you've got some print comics available now. You have your graphic novel available, and people can pick those up and buy them. They can, you know, they can go to your site and read your comics, and if they like them, they can support you by, you know, picking these up and buying them. But the trip there and the road there where you're providing the comics for free in the interim, instead of keeping people, you know, as not only as fans and readers, but also as consumers following your work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you end up eating the cost of producing the comic by putting it on the web. You know, you're paying for your art supplies, you're paying for the time it takes you to do it, essentially.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. But on the other hand, one of the things that I was attracted to the whole idea about it was the trip. It seemed to me like it was even faster than the using the direct market and independently publishing. Like I did, like I said, I did that miniseries for Antarctic Press, and I did not get even a tenth of what, you know, you would normally get for a published work like that. And it's not Antarctic Press's fault. It's just the fact that they have not as good a market penetration. I was unknown. Yeah. The series didn't, there was no way to advertise the series the way we wanted to. So it was a constellation of things. It's just the fault of being an indie guy that we didn't make very much money off of it. So by taking my stuff online and just finding the right people to plug it, I wound up being able to subsidize the work by doing other work, like doing freelance illustration work. I started up a freelance illustration career from doing online comics. I was able to, it served as a portfolio piece for me, so I could shop around to ad agencies and start working from home that way. So in terms of that, yeah, my whole career is around comics and illustration, but it's not working for Marvel and DC. And on the one hand, I've talked with people in the industry who think of me as being outside of the industry. You're not a professional in terms of, because you haven't worked for Marvel and DC. But on the other hand, it's like, this is what I wanted. I wanted to be able to draw for a living, and I wanted to draw the things I like drawing and be able to turn people down if they give me a job that I don't want to do. And so that in itself is a small success. So I don't really feel like I gave anything away. As a matter of fact, I'm really grateful for the internet coming along when it did, because it meant that I didn't have to do a whole lot of jobs that I didn't like doing.
Well, that's definitely a great point, especially if I guess that's the thing, is I'm having a hang-up where I don't see the income coming in. It's like, well, this is a bad example because people, I mean, I guess you pay for newspapers, but it's like, I don't see, you know, a feasible way of, you know, even getting like 10 cents for my blog entries that I'm posting, not that I'm trying to, but if you can use it as a portfolio and you can use it as a springboard to do other work, then I can totally understand that.
Yeah, like look at what happened with what's that guy, Sean Baby, who did that popular blog, that pop culture blog, and now he's like doing columns for video game magazines.
Yeah, yeah. Well, same thing. Matt at X Entertainment's working for Toy Fair.
Yeah, there you go. But you did touch on something. Both you and Scott have touched on something that I really wanted to get at, because I really am curious about your dispositions as web content creators. Scott, you said that you don't advertise Nemu Nemu very much, if at all. Is that true?
Well, I take a different method to getting the word out there. I mean, I really think as a website owner and a web comic owner, you've got to use guerrilla marketing as far as getting the word out about what you do. I really see, I guess, what we do as, you know, just like any other website that's out there, you're just a number on, you know, on the block, and you've got to get your number out there to people and get people to come visit your site and whatnot. It's been very challenging. I mean, I'll look at some of the other web comics that are out there. I know Kitsy doesn't look at too many web comics, but, you know, I just like to go out there and see what everybody else is doing. And, you know, sometimes you're able to check out what their statistics are like. And, I mean, I'm just blown away by some of these comics, their total amount of traffic. After about a couple of months of looking at statistics and what they're doing, I started to see a kind of pattern of what kind of comics are popular and what kind of comics are not as popular. And I mean, it's kind of discouraging in a way, but in kind of a way, I think I still tell Kitsy that we've got a great product, and I think, you know, we can make it. We're just going to have to try a little bit harder to get stuff out there. I'm looking at Project Wonderful as a way. We did a one month long experiment with Project Wonderful to get some advertising out there, and we increased our traffic about 4 or 5 times.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah, just from doing Project Wonderful. I'd say within the month I spent about $40 on advertising, and our traffic went up like 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
what it normally is.
Okay, so you have messed around with advertising a little bit.
That was just a 1 month experiment just to see what the types of returns were, what comics brought back those types of returns, and that was part of my, you know, just some research that I did, looking at the popular comics that are out there, looking at what types of statistics they get, where their ad placement is at, and, you know, it's really not so much a science, but you just gotta really take a look at their statistics and where they're placing your ads so that you get good placement for your advertising dollar.
I see. That's an excellent point. You're thinking like a businessman. I one of the philosophies that I started out with when I started my online presence was I didn't want to ask anybody for anything. I wanted to let the work speak for itself. It's one of those like corny artistic things, you know? It's like, oh, the work should be enough.
So I had the same thing with Audra. I was like, you know, we gotta make friends. Make friends with people out there, and it's good to know who else is out there doing the same thing as you, because once you make that relationship, you can help each other out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Advertising with each other. I mean, putting sugary cereals on our site, you putting Nemu Nemu on sugary cereals site. I mean, it goes both ways. I see traffic coming from sugary cereals, and, you know, after you did your little post on Make Like a Tree Comics, I started seeing traffic coming in from there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, reciprocal linking is I'm sure everybody who's done web content agrees is king. But I've toyed around with advertising in the past, and I didn't look at it the same way you did, Scott. I didn't look at it as analytically. I was just like, well, this site's offering some good rates, and they've got a nice banner at the top. I'll just advertise there, and we'll see if people come. And I never got a good response that way. But you got me thinking about it. Maybe it's you have to think a little bit more about where the placement is. And I know Project Wonderful, they actually help give you more information about the advertiser, don't they? Like in terms of what their content is and whether or not I'm sorry, I keep stepping on you.
Oh, no. They give you really good statistics about how many impressions and page views they're getting, how many visitors per site. I'm not sure how accurate it is. I'm pretty sure their auditing is fairly accurate. I did realize, though, even though there might be a site that has a very large amount of traffic going to it, it really depends on where the placement of the banners are. Some of them put the banners underneath the comic, and you never get any traffic out of those comics.
Hmm.
But I would say during that month time, I would say our traffic grew 5%, five times what it normally is, and, you know, a lot of referrals from those sites that I was advertising on. It also depends on your banner ad campaign as well.
Mm-hmm.
The banner ad campaign has a big...
It has to be dynamic. It really has to stand out.
It either has to be dynamic, or it has to be something so funny that they're going to click on it, or they're just so curious about what it is, they're going to click on it, you know?
Right. So... And then in turn, you run ads on your site, which I'm sure is a little bit, you don't have to go into specifics, obviously, but I'm sure that helps subsidize the work on the website.
Right. If you run ads on the site, you get, you know, of course you're getting paid for those ads that are on the site. I did not run any Project Wonderful ads on our site. I just paid the money to see what it was going to be like. Our plans are probably to start running Project Wonderful ads on the site in order to subsidize the cost of running Project Wonderful ads on other people's sites.
Hmm. Well, and then there's like another aspect to that in terms of getting the word out is I think that there's the whole building a cult of personality around your work too, and that can't be overlooked. And that's something you get to do a lot more, I think, directly and effectively with webcomics is this idea that you get to interact with the fans directly and you build a public persona that way in those interactions, right? So... and there's people who've done it more effectively and less effectively. There are personalities in webcomics who are notorious, right? And there's ones who are relatively benign. So that's something that I at least try to think hard about in the way I behave online is I don't ever want to give the impression that I'm endorsing cynicism or ennui or unhappiness in any way, you know. So that's another thing that, to that extent, I'm at least paying attention to the way I'm marketing my sites.
I think that's the thing that I noticed as well was the ones that are really popular are the ones that aren't really, you know, they're not kid-friendly. They're not all ages appropriate. They've got a kind of wicked sense of humor, I guess, or a more
edgy
type of humor than, you know, Nemo Nemo would never be anywhere near that.
I hope not. That would give me nightmares. If I ever saw like an Adult Swim joke on a Nemu Nemu strip.
I mean, and that's kind of what made me a little bit depressed for a little while, because I was seeing what type of, you know, humor was actually becoming popular. But then again, I always, you know, jump back and look at what we got, and I just think that we've got a, you know, I think we've got a winning combination, and we got great characters and a great storyline that we haven't had the opportunity yet to fully divulge everything that we want to. So I think we'll be okay. We just have to really work hard to get the people who want to check out our comic to come and take a look at it.
Let me ask you something, Scott and Audra. I'm curious to find out if other people feel this way about it. Like, when, because of the fact that I tend to celebrate in my work a sense of, even though, you know, I'll qualify this, that the front is significantly more violent than Nemu Nemu, let's face it. But at the same time, I try to emphasize in my work a sense of wonder and enchantment and kind of like excitedness. That Superman 2 feeling is what I'm always craving in my work. When I find somebody who is equally as earnest in their work, I tend to get really, really excited about it, because it communicates. It really, you can tell the difference between somebody who's really, they're speaking from a sense of earnestness and enthusiasm for the kind of stuff they're doing over trying to be, and I'm not saying that everybody who's edgy and cool isn't earnest, but there is a, more often than not, I'm running into, when I do searches for webcomics, I find ones that are edgy and cool for the sake of being edgy and cool. You know what I'm saying? Do you find that that's happening with you when you find, when you do, like when I came across Nemu Nemu, it was like, it was one of those, that's it moments. Finally, I'm finding somebody out there who's really just trying to do well-crafted, good storytelling, and they're not trying to sell me on how hip they are. They're not. I don't know if you've ever seen that episode of Foster's Home for Imaginary Friends where Mac tries to be cool. Has anybody in the room seen this?
Oh, I haven't seen it in a while.
Okay. Well, there's this episode where he gets in with the cool kids, and like the cool kid just leans on this rock, and Mac is trying to say, okay, well, let's play basketball. He's like, no. That's not cool to play basketball. And he's like, well, why don't we, you know, play King of the Mountain? He's like, no, you don't do that. And he's like, well, what do? We stand by the rock. That's what we do to be cool. And, like, you don't do anything. It's all about being cool and nothing else, right? And sometimes I get that from a lot of webcomics that are trying to tap into that edginess and coolness. And again, I want to be careful to not say that all people who are edgy and cool are that way. But
right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I mean, without naming any comic strips that I've been looking at, I mean, I tend to look at it like, I mean, Audra and I have had this conversation many, many times, and kind of some weeks we're kind of look at each other and we're like, what are we doing wrong?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like you look at your traffic and you're not where you think you should be. And you kind of ask yourself, well, how are these guys getting so much traffic? You know, what are they doing that we're not doing? And I don't know. Sometimes I feel like, you know, that type of humor is where most of the people who are looking at webcomics is at, and sometimes that makes me sad. And other times I think a majority of the time I just say, let's just stick to our guns, and because there's no way we would ever venture down that road.
Nice.
I mean, it was never meant to be that way. The original story was a little bit edgier. But that's like that's a different type of story all in itself. I mean, it's more like a graphic novel type format. But the comic strip the way it is now, I haven't seen very many other strips that are like it. I mean,
There aren't very many other strips like it. As I go around looking for people to join Sugary Serials, it's disheartening sometimes, because it's like I come across sites where it's beautifully illustrated, but then I see the jokes and I'm like, well, they're not. That's not appropriate, you know. And I'm trying to steer clear of people who celebrate too much edginess, because even though I know that they might be able to tone it down for Sugary Serials, I don't want any of the edginess to trickle in. You know what I mean? People who are going to bring a certain sense of cynicism to the project, and I'm trying to specifically stick to people who do what you do, where it's like incredibly honest and forthright and just non-self-aware in its charmingness. Like I was saying how I sent you guys an email a while back where I was saying, like, as I was reading it, it felt like I'm watching a Miyazaki film, but it's not like, it's Miyazaki who can laugh at himself. It's not the majestic Miyazaki. This is Miyazaki who can make a cute joke. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think the closest comic that I've seen out there that came maybe close to what we're trying to get across is maybe Bumper Boy by Debbie Huey. I saw one of them while I was at San Diego Comic Con. She autographed it. I was like, oh, so cool. but I've had, you know, conversations with her via email, and I think she's almost at the same place where she's, you know, doing, she wants to be all ages friendly, and she's going to keep it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Really interesting talking with her.
Copper.
Yeah, and Kazu Kibuishi with his Copper comic strip as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Copper is definitely, I can totally see that. You know, I wonder how much of this, I mean, see, look what happened with Flight, with when they finally broke into the Scholastic market outside of the comics industry. This is something I've been wondering for a long time, and this is just like what I call a wondering. This is just a question mark in the front of my brain that I haven't found the solid answer for yet, but I wonder if part of this is because, like you just said, Scott, you sometimes wonder if the people who are reading webcomics, for the most part, the majority of them all like a certain kind of humor. And so the majority of people reading webcomics don't necessarily care for the kind of humor that you are celebrating. So that makes me wonder, like, well, gee, then maybe it's time to get other people to start reading more comics. And that was this whole inspiration for this going out and doing workshops thing that I started doing for myself is both as a way to subsidize my income, but also to kind of, like, evangelize. Because there are so many people out there who I think would appreciate what I'm doing on the front, but they're not the people who are going to comic stores. They're not the people who are reading webcomics right now. These are people who are maybe unaware that comics are still around, and I'm running into that a lot, where I'm running into huge groups of kids who have never read a comic book before, and they're ready for it, you know, and the teachers in the classrooms, they're ready for this thing. So I'm wondering, I don't know for sure. I mean, because then the other question comes up, are we really converting anybody? Are we really turning these people into comics lovers, or is it just this kind of this novelty for a day? You know, oh, who knew that you have to actually know how to write a story to make a comic book? Wow, I'm glad I learned that. The end. But at the same time, I just can't help but wonder, you know, there's got to be – I'm thinking that the audience is out there, and we need to find them outside of the traditional industry. And that's one of the powers of the web, but it's also one of the frustrations, because how do you do that? I don't know. I could be wrong.
I think, I tend to look back at how I got into comic books, and it all started with one of my friends showing me the X-Men, and, you know, I had no idea what the X-Men were. I was in, must have been in, what, fourth grade when I first saw the X-Men, and it was right around the time, right before Byrne and Claremont did their Dark Phoenix thing, and so I got in right at that moment.
Wow.
It just totally, you know, for a fourth grader, that type of storyline just blew me away. I mean, it was nothing that I've ever seen done in comic books where, you know, you actually have a character die. There was, you know, it was an ensemble cast, and they all had their own personalities. You know, I was so used to that, you know, like you were saying earlier about Batman, he's sitting in a coffee shop and talking with Commissioner Gordon. And
right.
I mean, and that's kind of what got me hooked in the first place is the story. The story was great. Top it off, you know, the artwork in that, in the comic book, I've never seen artwork for comics drawn that way. But even if I go even further back, if I'm really honest, my first experience was Neil Adams doing Green Lantern and Green Arrow. So, I mean, that kind of was, you know, but I had no idea what, you know, what comics. We were just reading comics. We weren't really collecting comics or anything like that. It was just something to read on the side. But, you know, I'm kind of wondering, where is that? How do you get kids to read the comics again?
Well, we are competing for
the attention.
of people who have so many different ways of taking up their time. Like, internet is one, comic books are another, video games, TV, not even radio anymore, iPods. You know, like online music, all of those things are all competing for some attention. And I guess because comics really aren't that flashy and it's more old-fashioned in some ways, it's a little bit harder to kind of stand out against that, you know, that latest video game
that just came out. I think the problem is you got to read. That's
I think reading is that a lot of kids aren't doing anymore. Either that or they're not writing as they should be writing. And I mean, I see it a lot in how people converse with each other online. They really don't take the time to actually write or much less read what people are saying. So I mean, it's kind of a difficult time to really push something that, you know, that it's visually stimulating, but and it's not verbally intensive either. So, but it's just one of those things that it's kind of at a point where everything is trying to compete for that same attention of each and every single child or person out there, and
which is kind of why I think webcomics is a good way to penetrate into that comic reading market.
I think another thing about webcomics is that it's very instant gratification, like, you know, you can come back the next day and usually there's something that's put up, either a blog entry or another strip, or you know, a forum is going and there's discussions going on. I think those are things that, you know, are also big pluses for the webcomics industry, so to speak. Whereas with comics, you have to wait like a month, 2 months, you know, for manga, for translation, you have to wait like half a year for some of them. I think in a day of where you can get your Big Mac and fries, you know, in a drive-through within 30 minutes, you know, within a minute or two, you know, I think webcomics can also fit that mold, and it's just as good.
Yeah, there's that the immediacy of the interaction, the fact that you finished the page the night before. And like I had when I was updating the front on a weekly basis every Tuesday night, I would meet my readers in an IRC chat room they made, and we would discuss the newest page as it went up.
Mm.
So you get very instant gratification from that. That is one of the pluses.
Well, not only that, but it also plays into the fact that you guys are competing with all the other the video games, you know, phones, text messaging, and everything. But everything has become portable, so kids can play video games on the run, and they're not, you know, packing a book or a comic book in their backpack. No, they're packing their phone, their you know, portable video player and everything. But at least with webcomics, they might be able to access it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
Let me do the crass advertising plug here. If you go to sugarcereals.com, we have CBZ files, PSP-ready comics. We have the comics available in portable formats. So you can take it wherever you want. And if you have an iPhone, you can read it on your iPhone, too. But that is something that is really important to me as a creator, is to make sure that it's available in all those formats. Because, yeah, there's a generation of kids growing up now who don't necessarily care if it's in paper or not.
Yeah.
As a majority of the folks out there, I think there are some people. I mean, if you know, book sales are any indication, I'm sure that there are a lot of people who are fans of any particular series will actually spend the money to pick up the collection so that they can have it in their house or take it with them wherever they go or turn someone else onto it. So it's always a good thing. You can publish online and put it all together in a book, because you know, kind of like difficult. Just sit there all day on the computer screen to read every single comic.
Yeah, for me, I prefer reading a book rather than trying to scroll through pages and pages and pages of stuff online. But maybe that's just me.
No, I totally agree with that. I mean, the first webcomic that grabbed me was Same Difference by Derek Kirk Kim when it was updating. And I remember I fell so in love with it, and I visited the site every day or three times a week to see all the updates. But I knew the moment that thing was going to be in print that I was going to own it. Why? Because I loved it so much. You know, we're consumers, and whenever we want, we're going to consume. So, I mean, I think DVD sales are proof of that, and everybody talks about BitTorrenting and everything, but how many of us have bought a TV season? A TV season, which is available on TV for free, right? We buy TV seasons on DVD. I think that's proof, right?
Go ahead.
Well, actually, I did want to ask Carrie, since she's relatively new to comics. This is like where I was kind of heading with this. My point of attack on this whole issue is that there's people out there who just are completely unaware of comics as an art form and as an entertainment vehicle. And I think part of the key, at least this is, again, this is just my standpoint, and I would love to hear if there's any counter arguments on this. Part of the key is making people aware of the craftsmanship involved, and not to make them say, oh, you comics artists are so important, but more to get them to participate. Like for instance, let me just use this as an example. When I was growing up, I didn't watch foreign films very much, and the few foreign films I did see, I didn't get. And the moment, guys like Mark Rudolph, who is a film enthusiast, explains to me, oh, well, this is what the director's doing. And I could understand it suddenly. It was like a key, you know, it unlocked the door, and suddenly, now I can enjoy these movies because I understand a little bit about what is behind it all, and it's not this mysterious thing to me anymore. And I've noticed as I talk to adults and children who don't know much about comics, they see them, they think they're fun, but when I show them, well, there's a whole reason that this panel's big and this panel's small, and there's a reason that the artist chose to focus on this thing and not that thing. Suddenly they are participating in it, and they're enthusiasts about it, and then they seem to enjoy it more.
Mm.
I don't know. What do you guys think about that? Carrie, I'd love to hear your point of view on that.
Well, the biggest thing for me still is just understanding comics, just that there are so many little details that go into doing them that I don't immediately see when I pick it up. Sean has to explain things to me time and time and time again. Like I said on the forum, that, you know, sometimes I still have to ask him, okay, which panel do I read first, or which, you know, word bubble do I look at first? So I'm still learning, you know, just about that, let alone, like, the example that you gave when you answered me on the forum, saying that I have to look at the art as trying to describe it in words. If I describe each panel in words, then you're getting, you know, chapters full of content. And I still have to wrap my head around that. I mean, I understand that the visual aspect is like half of the comic, but I don't understand how much is truly there in just the artwork.
Yeah,
well,
it's like...
Go ahead, Sean.
Well, I was just going to say that Oh, never mind. Sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Well, what I'm curious about is by thinking about it a little bit more deeply than just enjoying the entertainment value, has that heightened the entertainment value for you at all? Or no? Or do you feel like we're just being snobs talking about this stuff? It's my curiosity.
No. I love, you know, any insight into it helps me to understand it more and get more out of it. I mean, Sean and I have had tons of conversations about that, and I ask him question after question, and he, you know, starts explaining, you know, why somebody did a panel this way versus another way, or what exactly with, you know, line work and the artwork. Actually, he used an example on your comic that in one of the pictures he said that you ended up outlining the characters in black so that they would pop out of the picture, and everything in the background was the outline was used in the same color as the actual.
Yeah, it was where you were using, like in the background mountain scenes and the Equalizer the Divide comic. If there was like a purple mountain, it'd be like a dark purple outline instead of a black outline to sort of give the appearance of perspective and stuff like that.
So, I mean, when he points that out to me, it just makes it mean so much more, because I still don't know about all the little details.
Well, Scott and Audra, what do you guys think? Is this just spreading pretentiousness, or do you think that there's something to this? I'm just curious what other – I don't get a chance to talk to many other artists who I can discuss this with. What do you think about that point of entry for people?
You know, I think everyone can see when it's bad artwork, and then I think you can, you know, when you see good artwork, you know it's good. I remember I just always go back to, you know, being that the teenager reading comic books and just enjoying picking up the comic book. And sometimes, you know, I'd buy it not for the story but for the artwork. Sometimes the story was, you know, really badly done, but the artwork was just so good that, you know, it was okay to just pick it up and see, you know, like what she was just saying right now about how, you know, you emphasize certain characters to differentiate from the background or put more emphasis on something. Some artists are so good that you don't even have to think about it. When you're looking at it,
mm-hmm.
you already know what's going on
mm-hmm.
because that's how good they are at the storytelling aspects of doing comic books. I don't know. What about you, Audra?
Actually, it does have a lot of merit. I think you know Scott touched on it a bit where he says the artist can actually lead you through the story and through the page without you even noticing that you're being moved through the page, and you're looking at the things that the artist wants you to look at, and you know you read the dialogue the way that they want you to read it. It's very interesting because there really is a method to it. I actually took a cartooning class when I was in college. It was an outreach program, so it wasn't any accredited course, but it was Dave Thorne. Dave Thorne, he's a local cartoonist here in Hawaii, and I think he's done some stuff with people on the mainland on a national level. And he had done about a six-week course, you know, meet one time a week for maybe about 3 hours, and it was like a workshop. And, you know, really he spoke about the little things that artists can do to make a story work. And it's the things you never really think about. Like, you know, if you're going to read it from left to right, you should be drawing the people left to right. If you're going to be, you know, trying to lead the person around the page, think about the word bubbles and the order of which it goes around. And, you know, the darkened lines around the important characters, the lightened lines around the background to kind of push the characters forward and back. Those all have a lot of merit. They really do. And I think it does add a very... for the people who know, like for say for me and for Scott or for you folks, when you see those things, you know that the person knows what they're doing, and it's not just kind of being thrown together, and it's a presented package for the educated viewer, but it's also very entertaining for the people who don't know. And it's like fine art, you know, you learn the techniques, you learn how they do things and why they do things the way they do, and then it adds a heightened understanding to the work that, understanding and appreciation for the work that is shown to you.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, I guess what I was trying to get at was, I don't know what I was trying to get at. I've had discussions with a few other cartoonists about this, and I don't know if it is to go back to something I talked about in a previous podcast. I went to the Carytown Book Fest, which is a book festival in Ann Arbor, and as part of my participation in the festival was I did a small comics workshop, and about 20 people showed up, and it was some 10-year-olds and some 80-year-old women and a 50-year-old guy from Europe, someplace. His English was a second language, clearly. And we just kind of dove in and talked about all the different aspects of making comics, and then we made some comics together. And it was really exciting to me, and I was kind of riding high on the whole experience of like, oh, you know, maybe I just introduced some people to the forum, and they're going to go out and buy some comics now. And I handed out some literature on, like, here's some books that apply, like, here's like some crossover books, like if you like this kind of author, you might like this kind of comic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking with Gary Reed, who is the former publisher of Caliber Press. He was there doing a panel discussion, and he asked me at the end, he said, do you think this was worth it? Do you think we really reached anybody, or was this just like a casual a curiosity, you know, a freak show for the people kind of thing? He didn't use those words, I'm interpreting. But and I had to wonder, is it, you know, am I wasting my time? am I going out making a bunch of noise that nobody cares about? Or do you think that this is something that we could possibly, as collectively, penetrate into a potential new markets with that?
I think Scott McCloud's been doing that too. With his, you know, he's going state to state talking about comics and
right.
promoting his book, and you know, his book really dives into just the nitty-gritty about how comics work and why they do what they do. So, I mean, he must be doing okay if he's going to office.
That's true.
Yeah.
But, you know what, for me, it reminds me of a humanities class I took in high school. You're going to have the people who don't really care, and they just take it because they got to take it, or there's nothing else to do, so, you know, they're gonna spend their time doing that. But then, you know, within that bunch of people that you speak to or that, you know, that you try and reach, there are going to be some people who actually take it to heart and go home and experience the world of comics the way that, you know, it was intended to be seen. It's not going to be everybody, and, you know, as much as we'd like it to be, but, you know, we slowly pick up fans and friends along the way, just by being there, I think, and just making the effort of going out and trying to educate people about comics and the techniques and know-how.
I agree. I think bottom line, it's up to the person. You're fighting against people's perception of comics and whether they just automatically think they're for kids or whether they've never been introduced to them. It's a matter of convincing them to accept them and to see something more to them. And you can try and try and try, and there's only going to be those people who are open-minded enough to check them out, to give it a chance, and you're not going to be able to convince other people that aren't willing to try to find something new.
You know, I've got to believe that there's an audience out there for comics simply because there's so many comic book movies coming out right now. I mean, movies based on comic characters. Anime is getting really big here. I mean, they got a whole channel devoted to that type of thing, so I think that there's a market for it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I think it's interesting.
Go ahead, John.
I was going to say, what I find interesting is that for so many people that seem like it seems like it's hard to get people into comics, or they're reluctant to get into it, but yet so many people so easily read the Sunday comics in strip form.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing that I've noticed about webcomics is that a lot of webcomics wrap themselves around the strip format because it's, I don't know if it's because it's a little bit more comfortable or if it's quicker or it's easier to get things out on a daily basis, but I'm curious if maybe, you know, switching the format, I know a lot of the comic companies have toyed around with this to horrible results and stuff, but if changing, you know, the way you perceive comics, I know that Scott McCloud was talking about one time with creating like a webcomics portal or whatever, or format where instead of seeing, you know, the comic like go long ways down the page or across the page, you click through the comic, like you would touch the comic to go to the next panel, and it was more or like a web-based interaction, and that people might be more, you know, responsive to that because they're used to, you know, web surfing or something as opposed to reading a comics on a page. Not that makes sense.
Yeah, he toyed around with that with a comic called The Right Number. I remember he launched some time ago, and he was using that BitPass micropayment system. This was a couple of years ago, if I remember right. And yeah, this is actually a pretty old discussion. Not to say that it shouldn't be talked about, but it's part of this. There's like this whole movement of people who think that you know, it should be explored. Infinite canvas, hyper comics, having interactivity, animation, all sorts of things on your comics is something that should be explored because it's on the web and we should take advantage of it. And I don't take a stance on it at all. I personally prefer the more analog to print because I like print. I grew up on print, but I think it's neat that there's people out there experimenting like that. And as a matter of fact, in the front, I even did an experimental thing that I thought turned out pretty okay, considering that it still works in analog, and it wound up making a neat effect if you look at all the pages end to end. But to go back to the strip format thing, I think there is something to be said that the strip format does lend itself better to the web. And as a matter of fact, there's another webcomics podcast out there called Webcomics Weekly by Scott Kurtz, Chris Straub. Who else? Dave Kellett and Brad Geiger, and they talk about that very subject, about how long form doesn't necessarily lend itself as easily to web format, and the reason why is because a lot of web content is kind of like, you go to a web page, beginning, middle, and end, it's on the latest post, right? You don't have to invest yourself too deeply into a lot of web pages, and so the more you can satisfy your readers with a daily visit, the better your traffic's going to be in the long run. And that was something I was a calculated decision in the formatting for Sugary Serials in terms of getting the stories rapidly rotating through the lineup. So it's not something that you have to invest yourself in for like 12 months at a time in order to be a fan of it. You can just read for 3 months and come back later on. But Nemu Nemu, I think, is one of those great strips where it is strip style, but there is like a I wouldn't say like an X-Men style continuity necessarily, but there is a connectivity between all the strips.
Yeah, there's we kind of base everything off of small chapters, and at first we try to think of maybe if we do it, each chapter would be a day in the life, but it kind of got a little bit difficult doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we looked at long format in the beginning, and I just kind of felt like, well, in the very beginning when you start doing your comic, you're not going to get people coming back right away if you start doing it in that long format. But maybe if we do something a little shorter that they didn't have to invest so much time in, you know, if they came back, you know, once every other day or something, they could at least catch on to what the story was about.
And also each strip, well, we try to make each strip just kind of stand on its own as well. So if the person doesn't come back for a good long time, they'll at least have a little bit of something, and then they can come back and they can catch up to whatever they had left off on.
Right. That's like a form of, I think it was Jim Shooter who was attributed with that quote, every comic is somebody's first comic. Mm-hmm. And so the writers had to, were instructed to write to that, and that's something that I think strip comics especially have a greater advantage in that you can kind of write to that, where you can write in this, like with something like, say, the front, I'm not going to be able to build any drama if I'm constantly trying to write each page for a new reader. You have to write some things with a payoff in mind, some things that you allude to and don't necessarily remind the reader of until, bam, the big reveal moment. And I can say that probably was frustrating for some people who were reading the online version to wait, you know, 12 months for a payoff on something. That's a lot of investment that you're asking for from readers.
Now, what's interesting is we haven't really followed up on the ending of our you have the first volume of Nemo Nemo in your hand, so you noticed that there was a little cliffhanger at the end.
Yes, there was.
We followed up on on that, and we've intended to. It's just that, you know, we've got so many thousands of things going on in our life right now. And so just the other day, someone had written to us or actually posted a comment on one of Audra's posts and said, when are you going to get back to that story? I mean, I guess people are actually waiting for it. We need to see what happens with that.
Can I just a like quick little tributary? What I request from you guys as a fan of the series is I want to see a standalone comic of a Hench and Rider adventure, where it's like an episode of the show told in a comic form. I think that would be awesome.
That's actually what we were planning. Yeah, Super Serials. Super Serials was that original idea was the.
Was to do a whole episode of Hench and Rider, but I think we've been talking about how we can kind of expand things and try new things, and we did want to do a long format comic, you know, like just short stories that would be told maybe within a week or so. And Hench and Rider was one of them that came up.
Oh,
so
wow.
I think it's very, very, very possible.
It was actually going to be like the origin of Space Cow and how he became Space Cow.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Space Cow, but he looks like a pig, and we wonder why, right?
right. Well, and the neat thing about that is then we get to participate in the show the way Anise and Penn and Kana participate in the show, right? It's like we're sitting with them. It's like it becomes kind of like it makes the world more fleshed out, I guess.
Yeah,
definitely.
There's so many things we just want to do, but I'm just like, just trying to keep up with everything.
Yeah, I probably say this as shouldn't, considering you guys are deadlining for Sugary Serials right now.
we have been really, like, brainstorming, and we're just trying to formulate the ideas and get them down on paper so that when I do have time, I'm definitely going to start on those.
I kind of think Nemo Nemo is it's almost like we approached Nemo Nemo as like the Star Wars trilogy, where Nemo Nemo is actually the middle story. Is that like the beginning that we haven't quite formulated yet? That would be like, you know, where did the pups come from, etc. And then like there's the ending story, which is kind of later on in when the kids grow up and all that type of thing. But we're kind of just focusing on the middle part right now.
Okay. Well, yeah, and I'm sure you guys have run into this. This is something that I ran into as I started doing my webcomic, because when you're working in the print industry, you tend to – you got crunch time and then you got downtime, right? You know, it's like, oh, we're deadlining, and then, oh, we got 2 weeks where we just don't do anything. We get post-traumatic stress disorder. We just kind of veg out because we don't want to have to deal with that ever again. But when you're in the daily grind of a webcomic – you're constantly in shape, and what happens is you tend to – I don't know if it's the same for you guys, but this is what I find, is that when you don't do it every day, you have to, like, get into the zone, quote-unquote, in order to start working again. But when you're doing a daily thing, you're always in the zone. And when you're always in the zone, your creativity just starts expanding and expanding and expanding, and suddenly you've got 70 stories that you're just dying to do, but you know you're never going to have time to do them all.
We got that kind of backlog.
Yeah, that's another thing that I was kind of like, I'm hoping will happen more with Sugary Cereals, is like a lot of cross pollination and collaboration between artists, because then that way, like with Mark and I doing the Galactic League of Marshals, we belt out those things in like, you know, 2 weeks. We put together an 8-page story just because we can share the load across the board.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm hoping that we can do more of that amongst ourselves, is like maybe do like what I was describing as like a Traveling Wilburys thing, where we get like 5 people all together to do one story, and then we just belt it out fast, and then we got finally get the idea out there. But then you got problems with like co-ownership and everything, and different temperaments. Right. I would never suggest anybody say like take their baby to something like that. This is something where you just have like, oh, I got the story about a kid who can make everything turn blue, you know, and it's just this vague, simple idea. Then the 5 people get together and just belt out the story very fast, and then you just get the satisfaction of that fast return on your idea investment.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows? We'll see. We're closing in. Well, we're at like an hour and a half now, guys, so I don't want to hold everybody up all night. So was there anything anybody wanted to touch on before we wrap it up? Or?
I just have one thought, is that the one thing that I've been kind of trying to do with we both have been trying to do at Nemo is just create fandom for Nemo Nemo itself, and I really do believe that fandom begets fandom. I mean, if you got one person who's crazy about your comic strip, and you know they really love what you do, and they're emailing you and everything, I mean, they're bound to tell their friends about it.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, their friends are probably into the same thing. They just haven't heard of your strip yet, so you know,
right.
Just keep pounding away at what you're doing, and you know, hopefully the word will get out. And the best thing is, stuff like this is making friends with everybody, and you can know what everybody's doing, and everybody can become fans of each other.
Yeah, there's that old joke, the only people reading webcomics are webcomics artists.
Well, with you guys, you're coming at it from several different ways. You've got the podcast that everybody's getting mentioned on. You've got, you know, various websites that either are mentioning other people's websites, or, you know, they're your actual websites. And you've got, you know, the forum for Sugary Cereals that everything is getting mentioned. So hopefully, you know, one way or another, there's going to be a whole bunch of people that are going to find all of you in one way or another.
Yeah.
Well, that's the hope anyway. I just want to make sure, Sean, did we get anywhere near where your curiosity was on the subject of webcomics?
No, actually, you touched on pretty much everything that I've written down.
Oh,
so,
cool.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's honestly, I think the thing that opens it up for me the most is thinking about it in terms of blogging, because it's something that I do naturally, but I don't think about it as... Okay, let me put it this way. I sort of put you guys on a pedestal, because I look at the stuff you're doing, and I really enjoy this as a fan. I really enjoy comics. I really enjoy art. And not, once again, not to say that, you know, writing a blog isn't, you know, the same thing. But when I'm doing my blog, I'm that's not my mindset. I'm not thinking like I'm doing these like they're art or something. And so when I look at, you know, you can consider sitting down and doing webcomics is almost like blogging. It's like that makes total sense to me, and that totally opens up my perspective. Like I said, I'm so stuck in this idea of doing the webcomic that you're doing as the profession. This is the job. This is where you're putting, you know, if you could put your 8 hours into this, this is where, you know, you would be getting paid and doing everything. And it was, like I said, I was having a hard time wrapping my brain around that.
Well, that is, I think for a lot of us, that is the agenda as well. But, I mean, if there's other ways you can get around to doing it, then you're happy to do that too. But I think it starts from the sense of, like, most bloggers begin with just being really passionate about a subject. Like, you started branding in the 80s, not as, this is a great business, and I want to be rich beyond my wildest dreams, because everybody's going to glom onto this idea. It started with something you were just interested in, you were passionate about, you liked talking about, and so you started doing it on your blog just for the fun of it. And I think that's where a lot of the better comics start from, is somebody who has, like, an idea that I think is really cute and they want to share it. And it's just whether people glom onto it or not, they're still going to do it. Those are the best kinds of comics to read, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I really think if you look at things from a fan perspective, not as an artist, but as a fan, and the fans that are out there, I think the more you write about what you're doing, the more sketches and drawings you put up on your website, I mean, that's just more content for people to look at. And the more content you put out there, it's even more opportunities for someone to find what you're doing. I mean, you'd be surprised at how many hits you get from places like Google just from people searching for certain key terms that we might have written about in our blog, and you get people stumbling into your blog. And then you see a sketch or a drawing, and then they're like, oh, what is this about? And you start reading your comic from that point. I mean, it's just, you know, looking at it from a fan perspective, give the fans what they want. I'm sure they would love to have more artwork, more stories, more, you know, more insight to what you're doing. Just start from that point.
Yeah.
And to go back to kind of tertiarily related is something Sean said, where you said that you put us on a pedestal because we're doing comics and this isn't something you do. So, you know, whenever you see somebody do something well that you maybe don't feel as confident doing, it always seems kind of magical. Even amongst the artists themselves, there's that kind of pedestal placing. Like I said, I've been reading the Nemu Nemu collection, and I feel so ashamed of myself whenever I see how great Kitsy's and Kimono Stereo's designs are. Their graphic design work, the presentation of the book is so beautiful that it itself is an entertainment factor of owning the book. And then I look at the front and I'm like, oh, I wish I had thought of such great design ideas as that. So even amongst ourselves, we're always looking at somebody else and going, oh, man, I wish I was that good. So the thing I try to remind myself of as a creator is that there's always a bigger fish, and anybody I admire, they in turn admire somebody else, and so on and so forth.
Okay.
But, I mean, even to come back to the craftsmanship of blogging, I mean, you yourself do a lot of evoking of an era, and just by communicating your passion and by doing it every day, there's a level of craftsmanship there that helps create what your site is. So, in my mind, all art forms are the same. They just have different advantages and different inflections, and there's craftsmanship all the way through, whether you're a writer or an artist or a painter or a dancer or an actor. So.
Definitely. I just, you know, it's hard, I guess, like you say, looking at other artists and everything. It's hard doing what I'm doing and looking at it like, I don't know, like it's anything more than just sort of throwing out dispatches every once in a while.
Okay, well, now that we've all patted ourselves on the back for what we do, we all do great work. Or maybe patting each other on the back. Maybe that's what we did more of anything else. But I thank you guys so much for showing up and getting the conversation going about... I haven't had a real webcomics conversation with more than one person at a time, so that was actually pretty interesting to me. So even if we did touch on some old topics, those listeners out there who are like, you know, been in webcomics for a long time, they fell asleep a long time ago, but that's okay.
Oh, thank you for scheduling the event, the talk shoot.
Oh. Yeah, so you didn't have to get up at 7 o'clock in the morning. Well, I know that Scott runs, and I didn't want to interfere with that. So I know how addictive that is to people. No, actually, it was just a happy accident. I just forgot that I had to be someplace at 1 o'clock, and so I had to quickly move it around. So just happy accident that it worked out that way. But I am going to try to, whenever we do schedule live episodes, I'm going to try to move the time around as much as possible to accommodate lots of different people. hopefully. Mm. And maybe until I find like a sweet spot where a lot of people are online and ready to listen to something like this. So, okay, well, in the meantime, I'd want to thank everybody who showed up. Sean Robert, he does a website called Branded in the 80s, which is brandedinthe80s, it's 80s.com. And his wife, Carrie, showed up. I was very grateful to get your input tonight. That was great. And then we have Scott and Audra of NemuNemu.com. That's NEMU-NEMU.com. And there are some great books and T-shirts and even plushies that anybody who is a fan of things that are sweet and honest and fun, they really should go there and spend money. I don't, that sounds like a joke, but I'm dead serious. This book is awesome. It is so, so good. It's one of my favorite books, and I am going to take it to my workshop on Monday to use. I'm doing a workshop on finding humor in comics. And one of the great things you guys do is you really play with that flexibility found in manga, where you can go from chibi style to hyper realistic style, all in the same story with the same characters. You guys are really great at that.
Oh, thank you.
So, yeah, I highly endorse that book. And then, of course, we're all involved with Sugary Cereals, sugarycereals.com. Cereals is spelled S-E-R-I-A-L-S. So, okay, unless anybody has any last thing they want to throw out there, any advertisement for their stuff, I'm going to close it down.
Yep. Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Have a great evening, everyone.
Bye-bye.
So long.